You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema with Big Willie and the Samurai, bringing class to trash since 1977.
All right, everybody, welcome to the GGTMC. We are back. We are ready to go. We are hoping that the Skype doesn't crap out on us here over at the GGTMC headquarters in both the great state of Pennsylvania and the great state of Kentucky. That connection has been a little shoddy this morning, so we hope we get to it. This is episode 401. We've been away for a couple weeks. I think we announced that we were going to be doing a top 30 show this week or not. But if we did, that's not happening. we got some, scheduling conflicts, things like that. So Todd and I put together a little Arrow show for you guys. As you know, we have, I heard the Skype crap out just like a second ago again. We have a serious backlog of Arrow material. So, we're getting through that stuff and kind of everything else we can, and just kind of hanging on by the skin of our teeth lately. But we'll get there, as we always say. I'm not going to make any more excuses. It is what it is. But this is episode 401, and we're doing Slugs from I think it's 88. Is it 8? No, it's 90. Yeah, it's 88.
I believe 88.
Yeah,
88.
Yeah, that's crazy. I seem to always think that movie came out like it feels more like a, I don't know, it sounds stupid to say, but it feels more like an 83, 84 than an 88.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's a throwback.
Yeah. And the other film is Dark Water from 2002, directed by Hideo Nakata. Nakata?
Yes. Not to be confused with the Nunsploitation film.
Yes, yes. And Slugs, of course.
That has the S at the end.
Slugs, of course, is directed by Juan Piquer Simon, who, for those of you who may not know or may not put two and two together sometimes, same director as Pieces. So It's interesting. His view of America is unique. And quite enjoyable, actually. So It's almost like a weird alternate universe. It's like an alternate DC universe of our America, but it's okay. I enjoy his look at America. So we'll get to those in a little bit. It's just me and Todd this week. Will's very busy. It seems like one of us is always very busy. So, and Todd's always very busy as well, but I don't want to, say that Todd's never busy because he's always around. He seems to be the anchor, lately, but,
yeah,
it is what it is. That's about all I got for the intro here. Let's get into what we've been watching and hope the Skype doesn't crap out a bunch of times. I've heard it knock out twice. It's almost like a rhythmic thing.
Yeah.
It's very strange and very bothersome, so hopefully it won't stay this way. But go ahead, Todd. What have you been watching lately?
Let's see. American Yakuza 2 back-to-back, which I really did not enjoy. It was pretty painful to get through. Michael Rooker can't save it, and it's just horrible. Skip it. I caught Wonder Woman at the theater, and it was really good.
Wonder Woman.
I was kind of upset she didn't do the spin around to change out of her clothes thing, but yeah, what can you do?
Yeah.
It's good. It's really good. I mean, it has the same problems that a lot of superhero movies do, and especially DC movies, is that, you know, they throw a bunch of really shitty CG at the back end. But it's good. It's fun, and it's, you know, it's solid action, and you know, Gal Gadot proves that she's absolutely capable of carrying a film, and, you know, good on her.
Mm-hmm.
I caught The Accountant with Ben Affleck, which was pretty good. It gets a little weird towards the back end, just the way that the plot goes, but it's good. It's solid, little action thing. I wouldn't put it in the exceptional realm. It's kind of one of those movies in the Luc Besson produced kind of like Taken and, you know, The Gunman and all those kind of movies.
Yeah.
It's kind of in that vein.
And there you go.
And John Barenthal's in it, so.
Yeah, it looked a little, what's the word I'm looking for? A little like The American, sort of, but less stylish.
Yeah. No, that's a pretty good way to describe it.
Yeah.
I like The American more, if I was being perfectly honest.
I haven't even seen The Accountant.
This is good.
I haven't even seen The Accountant, but I can already tell you I like The American more.
Yeah. Not in hard to figure out. Went from that to I finally caught Rogue One, and it was good. It was about I liked it a little bit less than Force Awakens at this point. I mean, the new Star Wars movies haven't really been knocking my socks off, but they've been good. They've been good enough for what they are.
Yeah.
The CG Peter Cushing was absolutely fucking god-awful, as is the CG Leia. And it's I can't stomach that shit.
Yeah.
Outside of that, though, I mean, up until the last, 20, 30 minutes, this was kind of a standard sort of sci-fi action thing. And then it got a little bit better. It felt a little more like a Star Wars film. And it finished nice. So, yeah, it was worth it. But am I going to go back and revisit it and go nuts over it? No, I don't think so. caught Jason X finally. And it was fun. You know.
Oh, Jason, you had never seen it?
Nah.
Oh,
no.
Nice.
No. Up until this point, I'd only gotten up to number 6. And then I just skipped over all the other ones, and I went right to this one.
Yeah, as dumb as an idea as Jason in Space is, and of course, you know, it is one of those things and stuff. It is a fun slasher, and I enjoy it. I don't always like Jason's space costume, his space metamorphosis, but Kane Hodder's fun with his Jason performance. You know, the way he breathes and the way he turns his head. He's really, really good at it, and I remember liking
this thing.
Yeah. I remember liking the homage parts of it, like the little camp scenes and
Yeah.
That stuff was fun. I've only seen it once, but I remember smiling through most of it. So
yeah, I mean, as far as you know, Friday the 13th movies go, I think it's one of the better ones.
Yeah.
You know, one of the more what's the word I'm looking for? Freely fun. You know, it just kind of is. It just goes for the fun aspect rather than any kind of anything else that these things were, you know, when they were on Earth or whatever.
Yeah, it's got a great. It's got one of my favorite Friday the 13th kills in it. The frozen face one is great.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's the one everybody goes for. That was good. Rewatched Cobra. I mean, it's Cobra. So
yeah.
You really don't got to say more than that. caught Tickled, the documentary, which was bizarre, but it was entertaining. I think it kind of deflated at the end when you finally find out everything that's going on, and you're kind of like, okay. Which is kind of the way that it left me. But it was interesting. I don't know, these style of documentaries, and I've said this before, where the documentarian kind of makes himself the central character, it's not as interesting as some of the other stuff. Mm. Like Louis Malle, when he would do a documentary where he put himself in it, it was always about the people that he's interacting with rather than, you know, the story of him.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like a Morgan Spurlock or somebody like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, I mean, this was good. This was interesting. And again, it's another one that, I mean, like I said, once you get to the end, you're like, oh, eh. But it's interesting up till that point. It's certainly one of the more bizarre things that you could fetishize, but what are you going to do, man? Different strokes. I caught a little gem called Baby Brown from 1990. I think it was directed by a guy named Joe Ford. It was a South African movie. And this thing is just – I mean, if you love stupid, incompetent action movies, this is absolutely right up your alley. And, yeah, I had a ton of fun with it. I didn't really expect to, but yeah, it was a blast. Apparently he also did a sci-fi movie as well, which I couldn't seem to find anywhere, at this point, but, yeah, Baby Brown, this thing was, oh my God, it's incompetent. It's so, I mean, it's like Andy Sidaris by way of South Africa, kind of, but less competent than Andy Sidaris.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. Went from that, did a rewatch of Across 110th Street, which is still a great cop/blaxploitation film. Mm-hmm. Nothing more than it really needs to be said about that. Caught Girl Asleep, which it's a newer film from, I believe, Australia, 2015. And it's kind of like Napoleon Dynamite meets Guillermo del Toro, but not really. And I think it makes the mistake of having the realistic parts be so heightened and overblown that when you get to the fantasy parts, just like, well, it's just more of the same, really, and you're kind of watching a Bjork video. So,
Skype crapped out again.
The there funnier you're bits back. Are pretty.
Sorry, you're back.
Get it? Yeah. Am I back?
You're back.
What was I talking about? Am I still talking about Girl Asleep?
No. You're talking about what? I don't know what the hell you're talking about. just keep going.
All right, I'm just gonna keep going. Caught Baby Driver. Loved the shit out of it. Edgar
Wright.
Yeah,
I saw that. I saw that.
Oh my God, I went into it with medium expectations. I like Wright as a movie maker, as a filmmaker. I did not expect this thing to, and I was resisting it. I was resisting the shit out of it for the first like 20, 30 minutes. I was like, you're not going to impress me. You're not going to impress me. But then it's incredible, incredibly well orchestrated. Yeah, it's like a music. I mean, for people who don't like musicals, you might find things in this that are going to make you wince.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not really musical, but it's like it plays kind of like a musical with the way that it has a rhythm and the characters, the way that they do certain things is very, you know, musical oriented.
Yeah.
But it's still a crime movie, still a caper movie, and the action in it is absolutely phenomenal. It's so well timed, so well done, intense. You know, like I said on Facebook at one point, you know, George Miller would cream in his pants watching this movie. It's that good.
Nice.
And yeah, it's definitely a comeback for me for Edgar Wright, coming back from World's End, which I really didn't care for.
Yeah, I had a lot of problems with World's End too. I liked some of the camaraderie bits, but really by the time I got to the end of it, I was like, oh Jesus, come on.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then finally, I caught up with Fellini's Roma, and it's great. It's, you know. It's this would make a really good double bill with Orson Welles' F for Fake.
Fellini's Roma. Sorry, if you ever hear me talk,
yeah, Fellini's
Todd,
Roma.
Sorry, Todd. If you ever hear me talk, that means the Skype crapped out.
Oh, okay.
So sorry if I cut you off. That's why sometimes.
That's okay. That's all right. I understand. But Fellini's Roma is really, really good. Would I put it in top tier Fellini? Probably not for me. But it's, you know, it's nostalgia, it's, you know, commentary, it's faux documentary slash documentary. and just all done under the hand of a master. So definitely worth seeing. That's all I got, brother.
Nice. Yeah, you actually caught my interest with your Baby Driver review or thoughts, because got to be honest with you, the posters, the advertising, none of that stuff has done anything for me. And then after World's End, I was kind of like, you know what, I'll just, you know, if I ever come across Baby Driver in another Edgar Wright movie, you know, that's fine. But mm-hmm. I'm not going to be harping for it and stuff. But, yeah, I'm interested. I think Randy liked it quite a bit, too, I believe. So, yeah. I don't know. I'll definitely check it out, obviously. Okay. I only watched a few things. I know a lot of our listeners are going to be surprised to hear that I watch documentaries. Because that's pretty much all I watch in between the fictional films for the show. I just got to be honest with you guys. I was thinking about this the other day. There's just not a lot of fictional stuff that comes out anymore that just interests me as much. Maybe it's my age. Maybe it's just where I'm at, you know, personally. I don't know. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, I'm always looking for filmmakers. And I just don't feel like there's a lot of filmmakers making movies right now. But
it's become a lot more homogenized.
I just don't, you know, I don't have a whole lot of time anyway, so when I do want to watch
with documentaries,
when I do want to watch films, man, that Skype thing is going to be irritating, and I'm going to apologize now. Hopefully it'll clean itself up, but you'll hear Todd and I talk over each other every now and then. There was just a little moment right there, Todd, you probably didn't hear it, but oh man, it's gonna be a bitch. All right, a biatch. All right, let me get into a couple things I watched. I watched After Porn Ends 2. This is the sequel to After Porn Ends. Go figure.
Where did they pick up where the other one left off? Did they have to fill in some blanks?
They wiped up where the other one left off.
They mopped up.
Yeah, this one feels like, in some ways, it feels like kind of leftover interviews from the first one, but in other ways, it does get into some interesting things. There's one actor who, I can't remember his name, forgive me off the top of my head, but he ended up getting HIV in Brazil, and then he ended up spreading it like to two or three different women in some scenes and stuff, and he's kind of battling with that and trying to get through to his life, you know, and trying to understand these things, this decision he made and all that stuff. And then there's people like Lisa Ann who've made a career out of it. I think she had a serious satellite radio show for Fantasy Sports or something. I don't know. It basically, what I like about these documentaries on porn stars sometimes is the way people take a different approach to it. Some people see it as a curse, like you can't do anything else once you do this type of material. Some people see it as this is the only way they were going to get to where they are now.
Yeah, so, just look at Asia Carrera.
Yeah.
Asia Carrera.
Well, yeah, she was quite successful for a while, and then I think she's had some issues, though, over the last decade or so. But, well, yeah. But, I don't know that for sure. I don't keep up.
Is it
you fade. There? Yeah. You see, you went away again for a while.
Damn it.
I don't know why it's doing that. It's very strange.
Yeah, it's...
This, I don't know. Who knows? It just does it every now and then. It's almost like I said, it's almost like a rhythm. I mean, I'll be able to cut some of them out in editing. But anyway, that's behind the scenes stuff. But anyway, I like how they kind of show you all the ways that this can be maybe good for your career, maybe bad for your career, maybe good for your life, maybe bad for your life. I mean, I've said before, and I'll say in the past, porn stars make a decision. You know, it is what it is, and it's a shame that there's a stigma attached to it, because sex is a more natural thing than, well, I'm not going to say it's a more natural thing to the human condition than violence, but obviously violence is much more accepted than sex. And that's always strange to me.
In this country, at least.
Yeah, in this country, yeah. But it's always strange to me that something that's pretty harmless in a way, and I'm not talking about the behind-the-scenes world and the business world aspect of it. I know there's some ugliness in the porn world. There's some ugliness in the Hollywood world as well. And there's some ugliness in the sports world, and anything with big business and big dollars attached, there's ugliness in there somewhere. But I just find it interesting that there's still such a stigma after all this time for porn stars. It really is strange to me. Anyway, moving on. I watched S is for Stanley. This is the documentary that's on Netflix about Stanley Kubrick's driver. Can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he worked with Kubrick for, I don't know, about 20 years maybe or more, toward the back end of his career. Or maybe longer than 20 years, the back end of Stanley Kubrick's career. He didn't make a whole lot of films after Strangelove. I mean, everything was kind of well separated. I think he started working with him around Barry Lyndon time, maybe. So I guess only Barry Lyndon, and then that would be just The Shining, Full Metal Jacket, and Eyes Wide Shut, right? So I think there's only four films there. This is interesting. It's a different look at Stanley. It's kind of sweet. There's a lot of handwritten notes, which is amazing. It's always great to see, you know, the kind of interior of the mind and to see Stanley's writing and stuff. For me, that's fascinating stuff, the way it is. A lot of things that people have said over the years, rumors of Stanley and stuff, kind of his OCD, his kind of things like that. All that kind of stuff kind of comes true in this. I mean, he is very much a very controlling type. Not in a bad way, but he just has his way. And, you know, you work for him, and he'll leave you notes about how to feed his dogs, how to feed his cats, how to do this, how to do that, what to buy, how many different types of this, you know, rubber band you have to buy, how many different types of this thing you have to buy, because he has to test each one. So he'd have him doing all these kinds of chores and stuff. So you can see the kind of meticulousness of Stanley Kubrick kind of coming through in these notes. But ultimately, it's a very sweet look at friendship and very touching. I found it very touching and stuff. And I knew Kubrick was a big animal lover. I didn't know he was as big an animal lover as this. He would basically take in just anything that would come into his property and just take care of it. So, he was a gentle, quiet, and, you know, reserved man, and he just so happened to be a filmmaker. Just, you know, I know those are odd mixes, but, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm kind of thankful for that as a fan, because it made his films unique, because, you know, he kind of lived in his own world. And I think that's what we kind of miss with filmmakers nowadays, is we don't have as many. I mean, I seriously don't think we have as many filmmakers that kind of live in their own world anymore. I mean, Edgar Wright might be a good example, though.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I mean, obviously, he's filtering things he's seen in his life, but
yes.
So is Kubrick in some ways, and maybe not as heavily as Edgar does, but
well, it's just a frame of reference of where they're,
right?
You know.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's more for Wright to draw on than there was when Kubrick was, than there was when Ford, than there was when.
Yeah, I mean, you can go back, and there's been people who've done videos of this and everything else, but you can go back and look at old films that Kubrick was a big fan of, and you can see stuff that Kubrick kind of cribbed, for lack of a better word, from old films and stuff, because that stuff informs you. That's all art is. Art, you know. I mean, this argument comes up every now and then on our Facebook page of people, you know, talking about so and so ripped so and so off, so and so, especially when Tarantino comes up.
Yeah.
But Edgar Wright's another good version of Tarantino in a lot of ways. These guys come up and stuff, they, you know, oh, he's just ripping off so-and-so. Yeah, he probably is. If I made a film, I would probably be ripping off, you know, little Walter Hill, little Tarantino, little Scorsese.
Well, I mean, I think Orson Welles once said, you know, I didn't borrow anything from these guys. I stole it outright.
Yeah.
Talking about guys like Ford and that.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, I mean, there's always going to be unique and new filmmakers, but even the unique and new ones, you're going to go back and look, and you'll see stuff that, if you really want to do the research, you'll find the stuff. And that always just bothers me. I hate when people do that. It bothers me to no end. I mean, everything's a derivative of everything. I don't understand why people can't get through that through their heads. It drives me crazy. As an ex-musician, it pisses me off when people get all up in arms about a song sounding like a song 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 40 years ago. I could sit down and show you that every song sounds like every other song from 20 and 30 and 40 years ago.
Yeah. Well, people like to nitpick about things that they just don't seem to gravitate towards.
Yeah.
So it's just, like, if they don't like a particular filmmaker, a particular band or whatever, they'll just point out these things as if they're faults rather than as if they're just a natural progression of how you become, you know, what they are.
Yep, exactly. But yeah, this is for Stanley's really good. It's a short little documentary, but it's really sweet. It's just really nice to see it. I guess Stanley had a lot of health problems toward the end. I know he smoked for quite a few years. I don't know when he quit smoking. But evidently, when he was done making Eyes Wide Shut, he was in pretty bad health. I had thought that he was in pretty good health and that he had just passed away in his sleep from an embolism, but his health wasn't good. He had trouble breathing. He was using oxygen tanks toward the end, which is usually a sign of emphysema or heart failure. So nobody, you know, they don't go into that in here, but I didn't know that. That was the one thing I pulled away from this, is I didn't know he was using oxygen tanks toward the end of his life. So obviously his health was not good. Either way, it's always great to see the great. There's some pictures in here I'd never seen before, so it's always great to see Stanley. You know, just the kind of guy I would have, you know. People often ask me if I had a, you know, if one person you could have breakfast with, or the one person you could have dinner with, and stuff. Kubrick would be the one. I would love to sit and just talk to that guy for a couple hours. Dennis Hopper, Uneasy Rider. I watched this. Terrible title. I don't like that Uneasy Rider title, but this is a good look at Dennis Hopper, another unique individual, to say the least, and arguably a filmmaker that changed the medium, right? So, because I'd say Easy Rider is probably one of the most influential films of all time. Hopper made quite a few films and quite a few pretty good films, but I think Easy Rider is, and I revisited that about 4 or 5 months ago. And going back and looking at it again with new eyes, because I'd always been a somewhat fan of it, not a huge fan, but going
back, Easy Rider?
Yeah. See, that's the way I would, when I went back and watched it again, I was like, I'm going to watch this again, because I had the Criterion Blu-ray. I hadn't seen it in a long time. I'd read an article about how few filmmakers make their, you know, very few filmmakers get to make their Citizen Kane, or their film that changes the world, their Citizen Kane, their Easy Rider. And I'm like, well, I don't think Easy Rider's the film that changed the world, but maybe I'm wrong. I'm going to go back and look at it. So I went back and looked at it, and yeah, I mean, there's a lot of influence comes from Easy Rider. A lot of modern filmmaking comes from Easy Rider, certainly. And I got a new appreciation for it. But anyway, Dennis Hopper, fascinating man. One of my favorite actors of all time. Really a shame that he passed away when he did, especially because I think, you know, his illness could have been avoided maybe if he'd have gotten checked up a little earlier. Not that this is a PSA type podcast, but yeah, you know, get that prostate checked there, boys.
Ooh, yeah. And plus it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, have Todd check it for you.
Yeah. Just spit on them two fingers, boy.
That'll segue into my next film called Mostly Sunny. Mostly Sunny is, again, about a porn star, about Sunny Leone, who is a porn star, and she's kind of segued
that. Sensing a theme here.
Yeah. She's segued, wait till I get to slugs. Anyway, she's kind of segued that porn stardom into being one of the bigger stars in India, in Bollywood. And she's beautiful.
Doing like regular movies?
Yeah, regular movies in India, you know. So Bollywood is probably bigger than Hollywood at this point. It has been for some time. They make huge movies over there, as you know, and we don't see a lot of them here. But we see, although Netflix is starting to pick up quite a bit of that stuff, and they really throw money at these movies. I mean, if you want to see some serious production design, some serious high budgets and stuff, check out some Bollywood stuff, especially some of their action stuff. And I mean, they really go balls to the wall. And she's a beautiful lady, probably one of the more beautiful porn stars you'll ever see, but not to say that other porn stars aren't beautiful, to each their own, but I just think she's a traditionally beautiful girl. And this is a kind of interesting thing. I mean, it kind of gets again into that world a little bit of the stigma of it and stuff. And she has to deal with her parents, and her mom didn't like it at all, and her dad didn't like it, but he kind of, you know, accepted it for what it was. And it's just interesting. And then finally I watched Netflix. When I came across Netflix, kind of puts out films every now and then that I hear about but don't see anywhere, and then all of a sudden they pop up. This one's called Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. Looks like it's mostly about Hulk Hogan's sex tape trial. It is, in a way, the Gawker trial. Look, I've never been a fan of gossip rags and things like that, but I do believe in the right to report and the right for free press. I do believe in that. And as much as I don't read gossip things and stuff like that, I think, you know, the world has every right to talk about Hulk Hogan's penis if they want to. If it gets out there, then they have the right to speak about it. And you're a public figure, get over it. That's what it is. Do I like it? No. I don't like it at all. I'd fucking hate it if I was a public figure. Yeah. But I think that you should have the right to talk about it. And anyway, this gets into a very strange area of how did Hogan, was he able to afford? Because he was in pretty bad shape financially at the time of this trial. And this trial cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Like, how did he afford it and all that stuff? And then you come to find out that the guy that founded PayPal paid for the whole thing behind the scenes because Gawker had written an article about him being gay years before. And, oh, man, it just gets into some seedy territory of politicians and billionaires controlling the press, man. So it gets really weird. Why is my wife texting me? That's not good at 5:55 in the morning. But yeah, it's interesting. She's just telling me one of the dogs is outside. Okay. One of my puppies. All right.
Well, now you know who let the dogs out.
Yeah. Woof. 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 Woof.
That was horrible.
That was really bad.
Yeah, I should be spanked.
Who let the slugs out? Yeah, you're directing that film, right, Spanked? Are you going to do that one?
I might.
All right, we're not going to take a break. We're going to hop right into our first review here. For the sake of time, it is July 4th. Happy July 4th to Americans and to people who like Americans and people who like fireworks who've let all their fireworks off before the 4th and now probably
and
still
they always
have
seem to have more.
Yeah. And for us dog owners, it's always pleasant to listen to fireworks every day for like a week and a half. Because dogs love fireworks. I don't know if you guys know that, but they typically do. My bulldogs don't really mind the fireworks so much. One of my bulldogs is a little neurotic. She doesn't care for them, but my boy bulldog, he could sleep through. There's this great kind of meme out there of bulldog, the only breed of dog that can sleep through a tornado, but the minute you open a bag of treats from two houses down, they're wide awake.
Yeah.
And that's my boy bulldog, and it says Bronson's his name. That's his go figure, his name's Bronson. But that's his MO completely. He'll sleep through anything. The house could be falling apart and he'd be asleep. But the minute you drop a piece of food, man, you can just hear those toenails hit the ground. And you can just hear him coming, man. He's looking for chow. And now we got a lab we saved that was out in the hot weather last summer. And my wife took her in. And I said, we're going to end up keeping this dog if you bring this dog in. She said, no, we're not. We're going to find it a home. And we didn't. We got a lab. So, you know. They don't, and the fun part is none of the bulldog doesn't like the lab, and the labs don't like the bulldog, so the lab doesn't like the bulldog. So it's a constant game of hey, one's outside, don't let the others out because they'll get in a fight. It's lovely, it's good times. You take for granted dogs liking each other, just like you take for granted people will like each other.
Yep, not so much.
Yep, doesn't always work out that way. My female bulldog's very territorial, and the lab's a little territorial. It's the females, guys.
Ain't it always?
Yeah. Anyway, our first film, I guess we'll just go chronological here. We'll just jump into some slugs. Our first film of the day is Slugs from 1988. While my internet pulls up here, what the hell is going on here? You know what? The good news is the Skype isn't, knock on wood here. The Skype hasn't been crapping out here the last 20 minutes, so maybe we'll get lucky there, bae.
I'm sure we're fine now.
Yeah. What is going on? Now my desktop computer is... Oh, there it goes. All right. Slugs, 1988. Original title?
Muerta.
Yeah, Slugs, and also Muerta Viscosa. Muerta Viscosa. Is that just a scientific word for slugs?
It sounds like death slime.
That's a great title. Gets back into the After Porn Ends 3, Death Slime. Yeah. All right, so this one is directed by Juan Piquer Simon, or J.P. Simon, as he's known in his American handle. Again, the director of Pieces. So this is didn't me and you do Pieces? Did me and you cover Pieces, or me and
I believe it was me and you.
Yeah, I think it was us. I don't think Will. Yeah, I don't think Will was on that one, or maybe he was. Maybe it was all three of us. I can't remember.
I don't remember.
Yeah. Anyway, interestingly, a lot of people forget that he directed Slugs, and that comes up actually on the DVD, is on the Blu-ray as well. So
I think it's always taken for granted that Slugs might just be an Italian kind of deal, yeah. But it's not. So
yeah, it's got a great poster on IMDb, that one with the vertebrae and the face on it and the slugs around the ears and stuff.
Yeah.
Says they slime, the they ooze, they kill. Yeah, this one I remember as well. Written by Jose Antonio Escriva. Ron Gantman did the novel, or the screenplay, I think. But I think that's actually Danny Hudson, I think, or something like that, that did the novel. There's a novel.
Sounds correct, yeah.
I almost have to read the novel of this at some point.
I'm sure it's like a Guy Smith kind of deal, yeah. Where it's just, you know, complete pulpy.
Yeah,
you know.
It'd have to be.
Oh, my God, yeah.
It would have to be. So, Arrow's put this out, and let me kind of grab the disc here and kind of go over a few things that Arrow, because they've really given it the treatment here. It's amazing that sometimes the movies that get these releases kind of baffles me. If you'd have told me that Slugs would have this greater release, I'd have told you you're crazy. But here it is. You got audio commentary from the author of the book. You have one from Chris Alexander, the former editor-in-chief of Fangoria, the last editor-in-chief of Fangoria. Fangoria is now collapsed, I believe.
Yes.
And you get some other interviews and things. And there's a great retrospective with the production manager, Larry Ann Evans, who at the time I thought, is that a guy or a girl? But it's a female, Larry Ann. And she goes through Lyons, New York, where they shot the film. And Lyons, New York is a very Rockwellian, I would say, type town where they shot this movie. But it definitely feels Italian / Spanish / European in a lot of ways, because, again, we'll get into that the way he kind of shoots America. But this is a great release. The transfer itself looks pretty good. Hadn't seen the movie in quite some time, probably since I was a kid. I remember being grossed out by it because slugs are kind of gross. I'm not a big fan of the slimy creatures. Not scared of them, obviously. Slugs don't do anything, but I hate stepping on them when they're outside my door or something, because it's gross, and I don't like to step on animals. I don't like to kill things.
Well, there's always that thought in the back of your head that, you know, even though you know that it's not going to do shit to you, that that slime is just going to somehow affect you.
It's going to get in the house, yeah, right?
And there's not just that, but I mean, you know, it's like it's kind of like when you were a kid playing, you know, don't touch the floor kind of deal. Yeah. It's like, hey, this could be acid.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah. There's a great moment here where I think the English teacher, I think she goes back to the high school, because evidently there's a scientist there at the high school who stays after hours working on experiments.
Yes, and he has the most well-stocked high school laboratory ever.
He really does. Again, this is a Spanish director making an American film. he knows nothing about America, obviously. Science is – you're lucky if you get a Bunsen burner. So anyway, he has a great moment where he talks about how snails move across their slime, and they can actually go across the edge of a razor, because the slime itself is like a protectant coat that they travel by. So don't know if that's true or not, but I didn't look it up because I don't like
it's
looking
true enough.
Yeah, I don't like right? looking, I don't like looking at slugs. I just don't, it's not ugh, it's just not it's not something I wanted to do research on, so I just don't like
Well, and the ones in here are, I just fucking fat and black, ugly, slimy.
Yeah. You know what, I'm gonna do a little research as we talk about it here, but I know somebody called them elvers. I don't know what what are elvers? Is that a type of slug?
I would imagine it has to be, but I couldn't tell you what that actually means.
At one point, somebody steps on a bunch of them, and I know those slugs had to have died.
Well, actually, it's a young eel, especially when undergoing mass migration upriver from the sea.
Oh, okay, an elver. I'm surprised there's not a stoner metal band called Elver.
Yeah, there probably is.
Yeah, yes. We are the elvers.
See that? Yeah. So you learn something new. That's funny though, because I, you know, Elvers, I wouldn't think that eels had those sort of antennae that these guys have.
Oh, I wouldn't know that either.
When they're showing, you know?
I wonder if the elvers are the type of eels that people eat more, like the pickled eel. And I'm not a eel eater.
No.
Never had one. Well, you had an eel before? Had some eel?
A metaphoric eel.
Oh, wait a minute now. What are we talking about there? I'm going to confess some things here. So I don't know if you want to lead on this or if you want me to?
Yeah,
I don't care.
I could take the lead on it.
All right, go ahead.
Let's see. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. So anyway, there's a small town and there's this landfill that got knocked over because they're putting in a new mall, and apparently all this toxic waste was in there, and it causes these slugs to come out and start just eating the shit out of people. It's not even a minute and a half into this thing. You got sex and death in the boat with Wayne and his girlfriend.
Yeah,
first of all, you know, you take a girl fishing and she doesn't want to go fishing. Clearly she's not dressed for it.
She's not dressed. She's got, she's wearing panties.
She's got a mini skirt on and that loose, t-shirt, but then she takes off the skirt cause she wants to go swimming. And then, you know, for a while there, you're like, what the hell? And then, you know, Wade falls into the water and then there's blood and then she screams and we get teased a little bit, but she doesn't actually take her top off.
Yeah.
I'm
not the world's greatest outdoorsman, but I know that, you know, hey, hun, if you're going to go fishing with me, let's wear a little bit more clothing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of accidents that can happen with some hooks.
Oh, yeah. You don't want that. That's pain.
That is painful.
But yeah, I mean, it's literally not even a minute and a half into the film, and you have everything that this film is right there summed up.
Get that fruit punch eruption from the light there.
Well, all the blood in this is like that tempura kind of grease crayon melted down kind of blood.
It's a super simple. Like it's like a really super. It's basically it's the most simple type of horror movie opening you can have, and.
Oh my God!
And really, it works.
But it tells you everything, but it tells you absolutely nothing because there's not even you don't even see a slug in the opening of it. You don't see anything.
Yeah. How big is that slug, too? By the way, I mean, are those slugs?
Yeah.
And first of all, if I see that many bubbles off to the right side, the starboard side, or whatever you want to call it, on my little boat at the very beginning, because it opens on a bunch of bubbles coming out of the water, right? And then it goes to the boat, and you get your scene, the white lace panties, and then. Dude falls in. You get the fruit punch.
And plus, they were French cut, I do believe.
Yeah. They were nice. If I see that many bubbles come out of any river I'm in, I'm like, we're getting the fuck out of here. That's a lot of fucking bubbles, man. I don't know what's in this lake, but I'm gone. Especially if I'm in Florida or something, you know?
Yeah.
A fucking crocodile or alligator or some shit.
Yeah, fuck that. we then go to, and it's amazing how this film moves along because it just, we go from these two idiots that we don't know to this drunk guy who's getting evicted who we don't know and we don't really care to because he's just kind of scummy.
Yeah. He's getting picked on by the local hoods.
Yeah. Well, and then they show up later as well.
The one lead hood, he's pretty funny.
Oh my God, the Buddy Ravel guy. Yeah,
he's such a cunt.
Oh my God, is he ever? But this is kind of the pattern for the film: is we meet these people who we don't care about, don't like, nothing, and they get killed, and that's pretty much, you know, that's the majority of the movie. Even the people that we're supposed to like, we don't really. I mean, right after we watch this drunk guy get killed, we cut to yuppie scum sitting there. And just getting drunk. And I want to touch on this here. This the Maureen character, who's like an alcoholic type person. And she's absolutely miserable. Nobody likes her. We see her again in the setup for the death of a person. And then we never see her again in the rest of the movie.
Yeah, I know.
So we don't know. We have no idea what happened to her. And that's the whole point of this movie, is that it doesn't give a shit.
Yeah.
Because we don't give a shit, because all she is the setup for a punchline that, you know, may or may not happen.
I would assume that the same thing happened to her happened to
But she doesn't, you know, but that's the thing, is that, you know, the day after, you know, when he's complaining, you know, she's just, you know, right as rain. She does nothing. And you would think that they would take the opportunity to take this one character who we've taken pains to show that she's an alcoholic, And that, you know, I mean, they actually intercut scenes of her drinking and watching TV shows with these two people getting killed in a greenhouse.
Yeah.
I mean, they actually stop the movie to intercut these two things, and then it means nothing.
Yeah. I've actually seen her in quite a few films. I didn't realize where I'd seen her from before. She was in Pulse Beat, the Daniel Green film we did, the aerobics film. And she's in The Exterminators of Year 3000. She's in Edge of the Axe.
Yeah, that's right.
Edge of the Axe. She's in that, too. It's got a very memorable cover, Edge of the Axe. But, yeah, she did quite a bit of stuff. Oh, she did a film with Javier Bardem in 93 called Golden Balls.
Ooh, I like it already.
Well, it's got a great cover. Javier Bardem was just kind of grabbing his package right on the cover of the film.
Well.
Yeah, I'll need to see this film.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean that's kind of the thing about the movie is that it just keeps going. It hits the ground with the wheels running. It doesn't give two shits about anything that's getting in its way. It's rolling right over.
Animals run amok film, right? So it's
very
basic it moves right along.
Right, but what it does also is that, you know, you get Don, who's the sanitation supervisor, and Mike Brady. Ha ha ha. Who's the health inspector, and these two guys are like they're the frickin' frack of the movie, and
the Scooby and Shaggy of the movie,
the Yosh and Stosh of this particular movie, and they're the Doug McClure, you know, everyman kind of characters that I think, and this goes back to what we were saying before we even got into this review, is that, you know, this movie's a complete throwback. It's almost like a last gasp for this sort of movie in a lot of ways. Yeah. This sort of movie where it was just regular Joes coming into these situations and meeting these extraordinary circumstances and having to figure a way out of it. And, you know, today it would just be, well, everybody's got fucking superpowers and they'll just blow shit up at the end. Okay, great. but back then, you know, it was just a guy. It was for me at least, it was heavy influence from Stephen King. And the way that he would have, you know, guys who would – the way that they always explained – well, it was always explained to me was Stephen King. People really liked his novels because his characters were the kind of people who would buy a 10-pack of underwear at Kmart. And I think that's very, very true. It was, you know, these relatable people. They're, you know, every man – they have no really special skills aside from, you know, whatever their job is maybe. But you know, the great part was – getting to, you know, watching them kind of two-fist their way through these situations and get inventive about how they were going to solve the problems that they come up with or that they encounter. And I really like that sort of thing. I love that sort of thing. The, you know, like Grizzly and Humanoids from the Deep and Piranha that kind of thing.
I like the small town aspect of it. I like the idea that the health inspector is hanging out with the, you know, the sewage guy.
Yeah.
Stupid as it sounds, I like that. I like that, you know, the idea of that. They meet each other at a restaurant and then, like, hey, how's it going? This is my wife. My wife has one wife speaks Spanish because obviously it's a Juan Piquer Simone film. So you have a mixed, kind of a intercontinental or a transcontinental cast here. Some of this movie was shot in Spain. We should say that. Some of it was shot in Spain. Some of it was shot in Lyons, New York.
Yes, so. And you could tell because they're 80 yard.
Yes, oh, big time.
heavily, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes terribly, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
Like, not
Frank Brenia.
Yeah. Frank Brenia. Yeah, he's there. The great Frank Brenia, who was in Pieces as well, great spaghetti Western actor, got one of the most unique faces in the world.
One of the most granite, he's the most granite looking guy ever.
Great eyebrows. Some of the voices like didn't fit. Like you were talking about that character, the Maureen character, I think was her name. Like her voice is terrible. Like it doesn't fit her character at all for me for some reason. It's terrible. It's like
And her and her husband's. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm such an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Like she just apologized for being an alcoholic.
Maybe I should see somebody about this. Yeah. You mean it? It's like
By the way, when she's cutting that salad, fucking gross.
Right, oh my God! There's so much about this movie, and that's my next note. Actually, is these slugs are indeed repulsive.
Yeah, this movie is a gross out type movie. It's gross.
It really just is a fucking. It's just repugnant, and it's meant to be.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah, when she's cutting that slug, you're just like, you're watching the thing with like dripping fucking shit out of it. And you're like, oh my God. And then later on, I think some slugs were harmed in the making of this.
Because,
you know, the doctor who happens to be British, also he cuts one in half and just the shit that oozes out of that thing.
It's gross.
I watched this while I was eating. I don't know whether that was a good idea or not.
I'll tell you this. I was eating and I watched Dark Water first because I remember slugs being, you know, well, it's not gross in the sense of like a cannibal film. It's gross in the sense that if just the idea of eating slugs or the idea of slugs eating you bothers you, then yeah. It's gross. But there's so many little touches of grossness in this.
It's really like – I mean, it's like disturbingly gross.
I mean, just the fact that he ends up eating that salad with it in it and he's constantly having these pains and stuff. I'm sitting there thinking, oh, it's so gross.
Oh, fucking cramps, buddy.
the slug cramps.
Get the bismuth.
Yeah. Kaopectate, man. Do something.
It ain't going to help. But I'm pretty sure that a lot of the scenes where they were showing the slugs, I think they were under crank because they're moving a lot faster than they would normally think they would. And they also – it gives them a really weird, creepy aspect, the way that the light kind of gleams off of their slimy little carcasses. I kind of like that. It gives it a nice little – a different little look to it. Mike Brady and the sheriff have a really prickly relationship, to put it mildly. First time we see them together,
I mean, in the sheriff's defense, you don't light the cigarette first and then ask if it's okay to smoke.
That's just a dick move.
That's just an asshole. You know.
Yeah.
I'd slug him.
Yeah. It's like, oh, were you using this? Yeah. That kind of move.
Yeah, it's not the thing. Like you pull the dildo out of the drawer and say, "Hey, do you ever masturbate?"
Yeah.
You know. Yes. Maybe you need to ask the masturbation question first. Or maybe you shouldn't do either one of those things. I don't know.
But then he tells the sheriff that there's rat shit in his candy. I mean,
he spits it out. Those sheriff scenes are atypical of the way I think Juan Pierre Seven sees American movies. Because he's like, what the fuck are you doing? Why do you do this? Yeah. Why do you do that? God damn it. Rah, 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 rah. You know, he's such a caricature of a sheriff, man.
Oh my God. Well, they're all caricatures in this movie. Straight down the line.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of caricatures, the score sounds like something out of Wide World of Sports.
Oh, sometimes it's really bad.
It's wildly inappropriate.
It is.
It's just like
it's almost like we're going on a fall break.
A fall break.
Yeah. It's almost completely out of left field. Matter of fact, there were times when I would look down or I'd be doing something while I was watching this movie, and the music would come on. I'd be like, "Did I change the channel? Did I pause it? What the fuck is going on? I don't remember this music at all.
Am I hearing something from another room?
Yeah. So bizarre.
No, you're not. Oh my God! The sheriff actually says that the death of the I think the drunk guy could have been from a raccoon.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking to myself, are you fucking kidding?
Yeah, really, Jesus!
I guess maybe if it's a rabbit, it could do some damage, but
a raccoon could scratch you up pretty good. But I don't know if it'll maim you.
I don't think it's going to strip your body. Yeah,
of course. Then
it's
again,
strip the skin off.
Yeah, then again, I don't think a slug can maim you either. But hey.
They got teeth.
Yeah, these do, yeah. And there's a great behind-the-scenes shot. I don't know if you watched any of the special features. There's a great behind-the-scenes shot of a giant finger and a giant slug that they shot to make it look. And I'm sitting there thinking, because I was watching this movie, and I was sitting there thinking, man, that house looks like a miniature. Surely it's not a miniature. And then I go watch the special features, and I'm like, holy fuck, that house was a miniature.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow.
Yeah, no, it was very – I'll say this about that. You know, the effects in this are pretty damn good.
Yeah, they are. They're old-school effects, and they're fun, and they work. And actually, this film got nominated for a Goya Award for effects.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I think he may have won it for this, actually. Yeah.
And I know that the guy that worked on this film with him – I can't remember what interview I watched and stuff, but they were saying that he's one of the – oh, yeah, it was a guy that worked with E.T. I worked on E.T. with Spielberg and stuff. But he said that Juan Pierre Simon shot special effects. Only person he ever knew who shot special effects better was maybe Spielberg, but he thought that Simon did a better job than Spielberg. I'm like, whoa.
Yeah, that's a bold-ass statement.
That is a bold statement right there, man. But, yeah, evidently the guy that worked on the special effects was an assistant to the guy that designed E.T.
Carlo Rambaldi.
Yeah, so I think they he had worked with Spielberg and he'd done a bunch of films, but he said that Simone was the best he'd ever worked with when it came to effects. I got to say, the miniatures and things like that, pretty good. And the explosions in this film, pretty outstanding.
They were great. Yeah. Even the fire effects, you know, there's only a couple times where you could tell the scales off.
Yeah.
But other than that, I mean, the effects in this are really, really impressive. And, you know, for the budget, I'm sure, you know, it's even more impressive. And it just proves that, you know, both the people doing the effects and Simone did, in fact, know how to shoot the – you know, they knew their jobs. and they knew how to put it together right. You get Don pulling lumps of hairy meat out of the sewer.
Gross. Again.
Which was absolutely fucking vile.
Gross. If those are special effects, they're very well done because that shit looked real.
It's just, yeah. It's just hairy meat.
there's a lot of just gross moments in this movie.
Speaking of gross moments, Donna in the high school there, she wears some of the most unflattering vinyl pants ever. and she's the one dating the Buddy Ravel lookalike whose name is Bobby. And these two, she's on that guy like she's hanging on him like a lamprey. She's, you know, just always kissing his neck, kissing his face, kissing. And he's just sitting there with that fucking look on his face that you want to smack right off him. And, you know, he's just standing there being a douchebag the entire time. And, of course, then later on, I mean, every kid in this movie is a jerk. I mean, the kids are even less sympathetic than the adults are.
Yeah, they are.
And then that of course, will pay off kind of with the Halloween party later on. Lots of snail trails in the movie, obviously. Oh, yeah, I already talked about that one. Bobby and Donna are after Donna's parents leave the she invites Bobby in for a little nookie, but he seems to want to the booze a little bit more.
Yeah. Oh man, what a stash,
Captain Jack! Like, oh
yeah, he wants some rum.
He does. Rum.
I didn't see JB. I was looking for JB in there. I didn't see any. I was kind of disappointed. I mean, I'm sure there was some in there.
Well, yeah, but I mean, speaking of product placement. You get the water commissioner's lunch brought to you by Diet Slice. You get Don's dinner brought to you by Brillo. I mean, there's some product placement going on in here. Just no J&B.
Brillo.
Yeah. There's just a prominent box of Brillo sitting in the background.
I like the old Coke bottles they had in there, the kind of fat Coke bottles. That we had when we were younger. I can't remember what you would call those, but they were more – they weren't the like small, kind of skinny Coke bottle with that classic design. They're kind of redone with the plastic bottles now, but they were kind of the round, fat one. And I guess they would hold 16 ounces of Coke. I can't remember. Yeah, I saw a couple of those in there. It took me back.
So much of this movie could. But yeah, Bobby and Donna are. He gets done having sex with her, and then he reaches for the booze.
Oh yeah,
because he's got to get a little more in him. And I'm thinking to myself, buddy, aren't you afraid of getting like whiskey dick?
But yeah, you know, here's the thing about movies: when guys that love to drink, I know a lot of guys that love to drink, but typically when they really want to get hammered, they stick to one thing. You know, like today I'm going to drink rum. Yep. Today I'm going to drink tequila. You don't mix your tequila and your whiskey and your beers and everything, man, because you know obviously that's a party foul. That's a bad movie. Typically that ends up with brown mucus or slime coming out of your mouth. Throwing up, in my experience. Now maybe I'm a lightweight, but you know if I know I'm going to get hammered, if I know I'm going to do a whiskey night, I'm backing off on the booze, so like the beers and things like that, because if I'm going to do whiskey, I'm going to be hammered. So I don't want to get this fucking dog shit sick, you know, where I'm throwing up like every fucking, I'm walking around like a dog dry heaving because I ate that slug in that salad. Oh, that pickled black meat.
How do you not look at your salad when you're eating? I mean, how much dressing does she put on this fucking salad that you don't notice the pieces of slug in it?
I know, it looked like a fucking vivisected penis in there. It's a huge slug, man. Big enough slug to make the head of lettuce move. That's what I love that scene. So the audience knows that there's a slug in that lettuce.
Yes.
So, can you imagine the, well, here's what I need, okay? I need a head of lettuce that moves on its own.
Some of this. You see a guy under the sink with a fucking rod.
Yeah. They probably spent like $20,000 on the head of lettuce. That would be a European film for you.
Yeah. Oh, God. Mike and the sheriff have some of the tritest dialogue ever. It's just the classic, I think there's mutant slugs down there. You're an idiot, kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The great thing he says is, maybe, just maybe, we're dealing with a mutant form of slug here. It kind of eats meat.
Out of the fucking blue. He's just, talk about pulling a theory out of your ass.
Yeah. I just love how he goes, maybe. He goes, now maybe, just maybe. That's my favorite part about that, is the just maybe. But yeah, they have a funny
interaction. You've got to be open to these things.
That interaction between them and the car is actually pretty well written. It's badly acted, but it's funny when they do the smoke thing. And he throws the thing out, littering $500 in the state. And then he says the thing about the candy, and he spits it out. And he goes, oh, Sheriff, that's a $500 fine. And the sheriff's like, suck my bitch. That's actually a pretty funny moment.
The movie hits every monster movie cliche in the book in the broadest way possible.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is not what anybody would call a refined film.
This is a straight-up drive-in movie in an era drive-in movies were dying, right? That's what this is.
This is the last gasp of this sort of movie in a lot of ways. You get the eye explosion of worms, which is just – I mean, and then later on you get – and I don't know – there's another corpse that, you know, its guts explode out. Like something from Alien Contamination, but I didn't know who the fuck that was supposed to be.
I don't know either.
It was just like there's just a corpse in a house, and it was like, okay, we're at this house now. Whose house is it? I don't know. Whose corpse is it? I don't know. And then it explodes. You're like, okay, and then you move on to the next scene. Yeah. That's about the level of involvement you're really supposed to have with the movie.
Yeah.
It's quote unquote worth a try to potentially blow up the whole town with the lithium mixture. There.
Oh, yeah.
It's worth a try.
Worth a shot.
I love that they're like, oh, this stuff's going to explode. And this is after Don is, you know, goes through the pains of telling everybody that there's so much methane down in the sewers that, you know, more methane down in the sewers than there's on the entire planet or some shit like that.
Yeah.
But we're gonna go explode stuff down in the sewers.
Yeah. Well, it gives us a great setup for the fire shooting out of the manhole, right?
Yep. Yep. That chud-like... explosive manhole. And Don's pretty laid back about everything despite what's going on. He's, you know, playing football in the front yard with his kids. His boys are going to a party. He's like, he's cash about it, you know. Just whatever, man.
Just so everybody that, just so everybody that knows and listens to the show, yes, I did skip the easy joke when Todd said explosive manhole. But you can fill it in.
The world is a sadder place for that.
Yeah. Sometimes I do skip the jokes, okay?
Come on. How could you skip them on this one?
Yeah. Well, explosive manhole is way too easy. Especially with the guy that ate the slug salad.
Yeah. Ooh. this is gleefully exploitive trash through and through. So much fun. You get the teens dancing at the Halloween party is fucking top notch.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's one of the first shots we get in the dance, and there's one, I think it's one girl right in the center of the frame, and she just stands out with her moves. She draws your eye to her.
Does she ever?
It's just, it's so fucking, oh my God. And I'm sitting there and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, fuck, I probably danced like that too. As the first thing that I'm thinking is, Jesus Christ, that was probably me at one point in time.
Yep. That was probably all of us at one point in time, right?
Yeah. The one kid says to the other kid, you're an asshole right down to steerage, which is just such a great line.
That is a good line, actually.
This kills off people you wouldn't think it was going to kill off, and then it kills off people that you know are going to die. So
yeah.
It just really is kind of – it's willy-nilly about who it wants to keep and who it wants to kill.
Yeah.
Fast-paced, fun, dumb. It's as pizza and beer as you can get for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this does have my favorite, one of my favorite action
tropes. I'd skip the pizza, but I agree. It is pizza and beer, but if I'm watching it, I'd skip the pizza.
Yeah, you probably want to get drunk before you do anything else.
I mean, I guess it just depends. I mean, you know, if you're not grossed out.
Don't get it with anchovies.
Yeah. That anchovy's still moving.
That's not a salad. That's good anchovy. This has my favorite action trope, which is a guy hanging over like a danger, like a precipice or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
You know, stuff like Poseidon Adventure, Star Trek First Contact, you know, all these kind of movies, Beware the Blob. I just love that thing where the guy's, you know, hanging on for dear life over top of something that could kill him. I don't know why. I just – it's always something that I gravitate towards, and I love it. I love when it happens, and it instantly puts me in a good mood, even if the rest of the movie is shit.
Nice.
And yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. I mean, this is a visceral, very visceral, you know, just kind of gross out monster movie with plenty of everything that it says it's going to give you. It delivers 100%.
Yeah, it totally does. I think, I totally agree with you in what you're saying. This is not a classically good movie.
No.
But it is exactly what you think it would be, which is a movie called Slugs.
Because isn't that what the tagline for Pieces is?
Yeah, it's exactly
what you think it is.
Yeah, it's exactly what you think it is. I mean, it's a gross out movie. Just them talking about the salad after they ate it.
Yeah,
made me almost as sick as watching her cut the salad. because at that point you had seen what she had cut up in the salad, so you're just like, oh, fuck, man, and fucking those black olives with that chocolate cream.
Oh. It's
gross, man. I can't get the image out of my head. She's just chopping that salad like crazy. Shopping broccoli. Anyway, I don't know where that came from. Dana
Carvey. Turkey TV, buddy.
Yeah. Okay. I'll get in a little bit here. You know, basically one of my questions at the beginning of my notes here is, are slugs gross? I just think they are. I just think they're just they're a gross creature. Again, I don't kill them on purpose. I was never one of those kids that poured salt on them or anything like that. Or, you know, I never picked them up and moved them either, though. I just try to avoid them. Now, I've stepped on more than a few in my day. That's gross, too, by the way. Cleaning up dead slug and stepping on slugs, because that's like a banana peel, bud. They'll take you right out. I mean, you're like in a silent movie, you know? Like, whoop, whoop, whoop. You know, there goes Sammy down the steps. So, you know, it's just crazy. Grandpa at the beginning, he likes to nibble on the Southern Comfort, man. Southern Comfort, that's from my neck of the woods. It's another one of those.
Oh, buddy, I can't drink that stuff anymore. I had one very bad night.
Ooh, yeah, no, there's no
that
comfort.
That was the end of Southern Comfort.
Yeah, there's no comfort in Southern Comfort, let me tell you. At least, well, let me put it this way. It starts out that way, but it doesn't end well. It usually ends like the black olive salad.
Yes.
He also enjoys a nice solid pizza. I like how he bites into that old pizza and it's like blah, blah, blah. That was gross. I mean, there's so many moments in the movie that are just kind of gross. And I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the psychology of the slugs in my brain. But, you know, most movies where somebody eats some old pizza and spits it out, I'm not going to get grossed out. But already from the beginning, I'm like, oh, this fucking pizza's repulsive.
Yeah.
And it's like that bothered me.
Yeah, it's not the Cobretti moment you wanted it to be.
Yeah, yeah. There's a scene in this movie where our lead is Michael Garfield, the actor. He's hanging out in the parking lot in his K car, his Chrysler K car, and he's got a real hot rod there, and just bad. It's a bad hero car, man. And he's somebody's got to tell your lead's got to have a cooler car than a K car. Okay, that's bad.
So bad.
That's bad news. He's hanging out in the parking lot and he's watching the kids make out and he's like, "Ooh, I'm like, you can go to jail for that nowadays, buddy."
That is totally not creepy.
Yeah. He's just hanging out in the parking lot watching other kids make out. It's like, ooh,
yeah, checking out Donna in the vinyl pants.
Yeah. Waiting to pick up the
Wicked Bitch of the East.
Yeah, the wicked bitch
of the West or whatever.
Because she always gives homework. She's such a bitch. Anyway, she does a little gardening. Great scene.
Well, admittedly, she has about the personality of a slug. So.
Yeah, she does. She's doing some gardening at one point. I like how they open that scene with talking about the greenhouse. death. Like, oh, did you hear about Bob and Mary? Oh, yeah, they blew up in a greenhouse. Oh, I really like them. Yeah, me too. So I see you've been doing some gardening.
Everybody knows knows everybody in this town.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah, yeah. And that stuff's fine.
But I didn't hear about the explosion.
Yeah, I really like that stuff. I like the small town aspects of the film because for that stuff really works for me quite a bit. Because I like when in movies when everybody knows everybody. Everybody's down at the Trombinos watching what's-his-name nosebleed into his water, which is gross. Again, that's gross. Yeah. And the sex scene is fucking gross.
Yeah.
Not during the sex. That's fine. But after, when she steps on the slugs that are on the floor made of hefty trash bags. And she steps on all those elvers and slides around, and she's got them all over her body.
Flops right onto them.
Oh, God, it's so gross, man. It's just that scene is amazing, by the way. That sex scene is fucking – that whole setup is amazing. It's just it's a gorehound's dream. It's a teenage boy's dream.
12-year-old boy's dream. It's
And it's just fucking gross. Again, it's just gross. The slugs on the
it's
toilet.
It's almost like the totally tasteless jokes – book of film.
Yeah. The slugs on the toilet gross me out. They showed that close-up of the toilet and there were slugs all over it. I was like, that's fucking gross. I don't know how many times in my head.
They spontaneously appear everywhere. It goes from being nothing to being 5 million of them.
yeah, which in reality, of course, this is some type of mutant slug because no slugs move that fast. Frank Phillips, the water guy, or Frank Brana, he has a great line. You don't have the authority to say happy birthday or something like that, which is, I don't know what the fuck that is, but it was funny. You don't have the authority to say happy birthday or something. It's so stupid. so dumb. The movie is really stupid. I think but it's that good kind of stupid that you remember from the videotape days and things. And I remember renting this and we'd watch it and I'd always kind of wince because this wasn't a favorite I'd watch. And the reason why I'd wince is because again, this grossed me out. And so we'd rent it sometimes when we had a buddy that would come over and stay with us, kind of a new friend or whatever you want to call it. And say, hey man, you seen slugs, man? Slugs is gross. You want to see slugs? And of course, you know, young boys are like, hey man, let's watch slugs. It's gross. And every time I would watch it, I'd be like, yeah, this movie's fucking gross. I don't want to watch it again. So I've seen it more than I've ever wanted to. And then we did it when Arrow put it out. I was like, fuck, I'm going to have to watch Slugs again.
You loved it.
Yeah. But no, this time.
Well, it's like the quote goes, you know, it's stupid and it knows that it's stupid and then it almost makes it smart.
Yeah.
Going back and looking
at it critically, it's a different experience, right? Because going back and looking at it with a critical eye and actually talking about it on a recording. I got a new kind of a newfound. I mean, I don't think it's a great film. I'll never say it's a great film, but I'd have a newfound appreciation for this thing, for the effects, for the greenhouse scene, which is great, the sex scene, which is great, the sewage scene, pulling out the possum meat or whatever that is. He gets his crowbar taken away from him. By the way, it's pretty great.
I can't be the only person who, when they were watching that particular scene, thought of porn genitals, like 1970s porn genitals. Maybe I am.
Maybe you are, but now I can't get that image out of my head.
Come on, man. The pink in the hair.
Oh, man. That's saggy possum labia.
Yeah.
Talk about some southern comfort.
I call the big one bitey.
yeah, that slug would bite. Ouch. Yeah, now I can't get that out of my head. Can you imagine this, the smell? Not of the quote-unquote labia. I'm talking about the the meat and the sewage. Jesus Christ. Walked into
just
one right there.
Just digging this hole.
Yeah. Just give me a shovel. I'll dig it deep. But yeah, this is full. Emilio Linder's in the film. He was in, I think he was in Pieces as well, but he's the one that ends up eating the slug salad and stuff. But he's been in a lot of movies. He was, I think he's still around, as a matter of fact, but he's worked with a lot of people and done a lot of things. He was in Goya's Ghost not too long ago, 2006. And my IMDb's acting up right now, or I'll tell you some other stuff he's been in, but he's a well-known actor, working actor. He's done a lot of stuff. And he was really good friends with Juan Picaro, evidently. So that's the reason why I think you see him in this movie. But and of course, he's in Pieces again. Like I said, he's in Pieces as well. So But he is really good. As a matter of fact, I didn't even realize that that was him, and his dubbing is actually not that bad. And I thought it was an American actor, and I kept thinking, who is that guy? I know that guy from some movie. And then when I started doing research, I realized it was a Spanish actor. And you look at the behind-the-scenes stuff, he did all of his stuff in Spain, and they kind of put that together. And you can, like you said, you can tell, but they do a pretty good job with the small-town stuff. It's fun going back and looking at those. There's two films that shot in Lyons, New York, and that was Lady in White and Slugs. And there was a great moment in that thing where she says that people in the town of Lyons, they still run across the fake slugs every now and then from the explosions. Isn't that crazy, man? That's great. That's a great story, actually, you know, running across fake slugs. And the fake slugs look essentially like cat shit, what they look like, you know, laying around on the ground. I don't know if I'd pick that up. I guess if you're in Lyons, New York, I guess it's probably like an urban legend. Like, oh, yeah, if you see cat shit, go ahead and pick it up. It's just a fake slug, you know. That's when they shot slugs there. Slugs. Who's seen this movie called Slugs? Most people wouldn't even know what I'm talking about. But, yeah, anyway, ooh, I just typed in looking for slugs, and I typed Dlug, D-L-U-G, and something came up. A TV show. I don't know. Anyway. But, yeah, I'm with you, man. It's fun. It's goofy. It is pizza and beer. Maybe skip the pizza. But it is a good film, and it does exactly what you want it to do. I mean, the cover that came with the Arrow release is gross. The covers for all of the releases I've seen of this are gross. And it works because of that. I think it's supposed to be a gross movie. Oh, man, Emilio Linder was in Monster Dog. That's a bad movie. Wow, that's a bad one.
I have that DVR'd right now.
Did Simone direct that? No, that was Fergasso.
No, yeah.
Oh, yes. That's the Alice Cooper movie. That's right. Ah, yes.
Yep.
Interesting. Anyway, yeah, man, that's all I really got to say. I mean, I think your mileage may vary as far as picking this Blu-ray up. Like I said, the transfer looks pretty good. It's a little fuzzy in spots, but it looks better than it's ever looked. I know that's a funny thing to say, and we always say it, but it's true. And yeah. Just like with Pieces, I mean, I never thought these two films would would have this type of treatment done to them. But, yeah, it works. So let's see your make or breaks, MVTs.
Make or break for me is the Bobby and Donna scene because it's just so viscerally just yeah. I can't imagine falling with exposed genitals on these fucking things.
No.
And
you do see a little bit of Bobby's hobby hanging out there.
Yeah, a little bit. enough to know it's going to get bitten off. That's the make or break. MVT for me is just the gross joyful attitude of it. It's really infectious. It just moves along fast. It is what it is. it's slugs. It's a movie. And I give it a 7 out of 10.
Nice. My make or break is, the sex scene. It's so great. I mean, it builds. That whole sequence is great. Him sitting, hanging out. Like, they don't know what his car looks like at this point. You know, him hanging out on the side of the street. It always gets me when people hide out in their cars and stake out. And like, come on, man. Am I the only one that – maybe I'm paranoid. I'm always checking the cars on the road when I'm pulling out. But, you know, pulling out. That was a little innuendo there. Emilio Linder was in a movie called Hot Panties from 1983. A group of boys and girls who are having fun in a discotheque are invited to a villa where some crazy people make them spend a very bad time. Mm-hmm. I need to see that. Sounds like it might be interesting. We got some reviews here. It's not essentially a film. It's probably a testimony of an age of liberation in Spain. Well, that's fun. That just means nudity. IMVT for the film is Juan Piquer Simón. I love it. I love the location, too. I almost gave it to Lyons, New York. It seems like a nice place to visit. I think if I ever... And then upstate New York or in New York again, I can maybe rent a car and get out and get a because I think upstate New York's a beautiful area. I'd like to head up there and check out Lyons, New York, and kind of walk around, maybe get my picture taken in front of the Trombinos there, bay. Because it's still there, evidently. It's closed, but the building's still there. I have maybe a slug hanging out of my mouth. And people walking by going, what a fucking weirdo. Must be a podcaster. probably got a blog. and my score for the film is a 6.75, just right below yours. I, you know, it's inadequacies kind of drive me a little crazy, but at the same time, they're heartwarming in a weird way.
Yeah.
And so it's a lot of fun, though. I mean, it's as goofy can get. Well, I shouldn't say that. I guess it could get a lot goofier, but it could be, you know, trying for comedy. I don't think it's trying for comedy at all. I think
it's
funny.
Not trauma levels of.
Yeah. It's funny because it's so earnest, right? It's not. It's not funny because they're trying for funny. But it works, man. It works. It's also there's a. I think a slug attacks a rat at one point.
guinea pig, I think, or a hamster or something.
Yeah. So if you're not into that, there's a lot of screaming going on. So anyway, that's our review of Slugs. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about Dark Water. We'll be back right after this.
If you like westerns, comedies, foreign films, horror movies, action adventure, and classic cinema, well, we don't have much of that, but if you like ass, titties, farting, burping, puffy nipples, poop, taboo porn, muffin tops, comic books, wrestling, mustaches, pie smashed on butts, cheese, taking baths, butt sex, gagging, milk, and the American flag, check out the Silva and Gold Podcast. We're the morons your mom warned you about while she was sitting on your face.
Silva and Gold. We talk about movies and shit. Find us on iTunes or silvaandgold.com.
Everybody, welcome back. We seem to be past our Skype issues. Most of that review went well in the first half. So, hey, all right. We're going to get into our second review here. Another release from Arrow. This is Dark Water, Hideo Nakata's film. And now, in the mid-90s to late 90s to early 2000s, Hideo Nakata was red hot in the horror world. I remember reading about Ring, and I remember reading about Ring 2, and Dark Water and Fangoria and all these things, and everybody was talking about...
He's almost like the poster boy for J-Horror, right?
Yeah, he really was, and he was just all over the place, man. He was red hot, and I think he didn't produce Ju-On, but Ju-On was... that was Shimizu or something? I can't remember how you say his name. Fuck, who cares? I'm terrible with that shit sometimes, but anyway, he was... around those areas. Anyway, he's done a lot of films since Dark Water, but I haven't seen anything past Ring 2. There's an interview with him that's pretty good on here where he talks about how he became a horror filmmaker and he never intended to be a horror filmmaker.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, telling in a weird way, because I think as him not being a horror filmmaker, I think is actually one of the benefits to, I think, some of his films working quite well. If that doesn't make sense, I'll kind of get into it and we'll see if it does make sense. But I sometimes think the best horror films are sometimes made by people who don't typically make horror films, because they don't kind of go through the paces. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There's only some filmmakers I think who are steady, well-made horror filmmakers that are really good at it. John Carpenter, for example, and things like that. But Carpenter might be the only example actually. You know, Kubrick made a great horror film in my opinion. Scorsese made a great horror film, in my opinion, with Cape Fear. Because really, Cape Fear, the back end of Cape Fear is nothing more than a Friday the 13th riff in a lot of ways. And it's really well done. So there's just something to be said about that. Anyway, Darkwater, 2002, directed by one Hideo Nakata, original title Hanagurai Mitsu no Sokokara.
Very good.
Not that bad. Maybe I could order the sushi next time.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
So this one is, again, adapted from a novel written by Koji Suzuki, who also wrote the Ring novel. He, that's another guy. He didn't set out to be a horror writer, but that's what he's kind of become. And it's interesting to me. So let me get into this. Now, first, I got to say, when this film came out, I really didn't have any interest in ever seeing it. It doesn't sound attractive to me as a fan. So I'll read the title here. A mother and her 6-year-old daughter move into a creepy apartment whose every surface is permeated by water.
Now, that description makes it sound like a Jean-Pierre Jeunet film.
Now, I like the idea that every surface is permeated by water, but I didn't feel like I could relate. And maybe this is the male side of me speaking, but at the time I didn't feel like when this came out I could relate to the mother and 6-year-old daughter. Now, 2002, I'm all of 29 years old. So at 29, I didn't really feel like I could relate to that. As a fan, I think I saw it probably 32, 33. I liked it quite a bit. But this is only the second time I've watched it. And as a 44-year-old man and a father of 2 children, this film, I'm going to be honest right now, this film hit me emotionally way more than I expected it to. And I'll get to that when I don't want to give anything away for those who haven't seen it. But, for me personally, there's a gut punch. And I did not expect that. And maybe, again, I'm kind of going through my life like anybody else. I was one of these guys who was blatantly against the belief that people change. I was like, people never change. They have kids. People are still the same. They do this. People are still the same. Well, I can tell you forthright and honestly, having children, raising children, growing up more, the difference between 29 and 44, there's a lot of fucking changing. And that is life in a nutshell. Life changes. It ebbs and flows. It does all kinds of things. So I think one of the most interesting things about art, novels, paintings, comic book drawings, movies, you name it, is that you can go back and revisit these things and they do change. They change the way you see them. Your perception of them changes. And I had a real experience with this film. So it's pretty interesting. And I'm not a fan of this genre. Let me be forthright. The J-horror stuff, I dug, but they really ran it into the ground.
In America. I've never been huge on this stuff.
I'm not a big fan of ghost stories in general, although I do think the Japanese, there's something about the Japanese cinema landscape where there's a certain amount of tragedy in their ghost stories that I find more interesting, especially than American ghost stories.
Yeah.
But ghosts don't scare me because I don't believe they exist and things. And not that werewolves do scare me, that's because I believe they exist. No, that's not the logic I'm trying to say here. I'm just saying that the idea of a door closing on its own doesn't really scare me that much. The idea of a door closing and somebody saying, "Hey, freeze, I'm here to fuck you in the butt," then that would scare me.
In that explosive manhole. Yeah,
that would scare me. Especially if it was my mom. Anyway.
There's videos of that for that kind of thing, too.
Yeah. This review just took a dark turn into dark water. but the idea of the little girls, the wet hair, the covered eyes, the sped up and slow and choppy editing.
Yeah.
All this stuff.
This doesn't really do that.
No. This doesn't. And that's what I'm going to get to. That's kind of more of like a Ring thing, right? And that stuff just got so ran into the ground. Now, I'm a fan of The Ring. I'm a fan of the Japanese version. I'm a fan of the Gore Verbinski remake. I even like The Ring 2 a little bit, the one that Nakata came over to America and made, because I think there's some interesting things in there visually. I just think all that stuff got ran into the ground by music videos and horror fans and stuff. Similar to like Saw and the way Saw kind of ran the torture porn thing into the ground.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have any problem with the quote unquote torture porn until like Saw 3. By the time you get to that point, it's like, okay, man, we get it. Okay. So like anything, it just gets ran to the ground. But The resurgence of the ghost story in the 90s is an interesting thing. I don't think it was meant to happen, but they have a long history of ghost stories in Japan. This goes back to a lot of classic films, and we could get into that, but I'm not going to this morning. But the kind of resurgence in the 90s is very interesting because you had these filmmakers. And Nakata, you know, he worked at Nikatsu Cinema, our studios, and was mostly, I think, a second-hand or second-unit director. And then kind of got his opportunity. He made like a TV movie or something, then kind of got his opportunity really with this film. Or not with this film, with Ring, to go full bore. And he has a very interesting visual style. Like, I think what Nakata does well is I think what every horror filmmaker has to do well, in my opinion, is they have to set up a mood and an atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And if you can buy into the world they create, that makes the horror or the fear that much more great. And I think that this film, for me, I think what works is the dilapidated hotel building, the atmosphere, the way it's shot kind of ominously, always from below, the way it's quiet. You know it's an old building. You know it's overcrowded, but you never really see anybody except a couple old ladies, the super.
And you never see anybody in the halls, ever.
Yeah, so there's this sense of almost shiningness to it, this sense of isolation, which I think works for the story we're being told, because in this story, you basically have a woman who's going through a divorce. She has some issues in her past. The divorce is getting really ugly because now the issues from her past is basically some mental illness, perhaps depression, postpartum depression. Who knows? There's a daughter in between these two. It's just getting nasty. So that right there, it's horrible. It's not horror, but that's horrible to think about. Because there's always somebody that suffers in that. It's usually not the two people that are fighting. It's always the one that's in between. There's kind of a great flashback sequence to another little girl who is kind of forgotten about. And there's something tragic about the forgotten child, right? The child that's neglected because of the importance of mom's job or dad's job or you know, something like that. And I can relate to that. My dad never was around growing up because he'd rather be at the bar and then he would be at home with his family. So I can relate to that aspect of it, but there's something that's kind of tragic about that whole thing and sad. Mm-hmm. And I think it sets up the movie pretty good because what you have is you have this lead, the mother. She is constantly questioning herself. And I think that's where the real horror comes from in this movie. What's her name? I can't remember her name now off the top of my head. The actress, Hitomi Kuroki.
Yeah.
Her questioning herself all the time is part of what I really like about this. She's questioning her own sanity. Is she seeing these things? Is she not seeing these things? Is she a good mom? Is she a bad mom?
And Nakata does it well enough that, you know, you start to buy into the paranoia of, is this real? Is this in her head? Is, you know, what's going on here?
Yeah. And the way
he's very well constructed.
Yeah, the way he sets it up. I mean, like, sometimes he'll just pan to the steps, and then he just kind of pans away. And it's simple little touches like that that I find more terrifying than, you know, the jump cuts or the stingers that you get in horror films. Not that a stinger doesn't scare me. I mean, I'm a human being. I've been to a horror film and somebody, you know, zing, and it's like, holy shit, what just happened? You know, I mean, but that's a basic horror trope. I think sometimes the creepiness of slow pans, establishing atmosphere and things like that really work. So let me get into the film a little bit more here. Like I said, this has its own created universe where, you know, a monster can exist. There's no question or logic as to why this happens. The water, that has to be, and I didn't read far enough into this to know, but I do know that water plays a strong part in Japanese culture, being that it's an island, essentially. The water's a big deal. Water's a big deal in all these films. Not just because the girls have wet hair and it's hanging down their face and stuff, but water, you know, a basis for life. You can get into all kinds of theories about water. But I think the way he uses water in this is actually pretty brilliant, in that the water is essentially the way our ghost-like presence moves around. There is a gross-out scene in this, by the way. When she drinks that water out of the faucet and it has a hair in it,
was fucking nauseating.
That's fucking gross, man.
Yeah.
The only thing that would have been worse is she'd have been eating the salad from slugs while drinking that water. That's fucking gross.
Yeah, man.
She looks at that water and she pours it out. I'm sitting there thinking, if I'd have saw that, I'd have thrown that fucking glass.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, no. And it was just it was a wad of hair. It's not like like one hair. Like originally it's one hair in the one scene, but then later on it's just a chunk of hair, and you're like, oh, my God. Yeah.
There's just something about that. You know,
it's fucking horrible. But it's interesting you're saying about the way that he uses water, and you know, I think it's very much supposed to be about how the Yoshimi character, the Hitomi Kuroki character, you know, it's kind of her worldview, mm-hmm. Always drowning, always doubting, always, yeah. You know, that sort of thing. It's a decay,
yeah.
You know, not only for the ghost character, but for her will, her mind, possibly, you know, all that sort of thing. I think it's very much in there. It's very well used to that effect. I mean, just look at the credits alone,
yeah.
Which is over that disgusting water with all that crap floating in it, with just the, you know, one little ray of light coming through to light it.
I know. I love that stuff. I love the rain. The rain's excessive. I love the hallways full of water. The scene with the apartment full of water is amazing. Mm-hmm. The like I said, the glass of water with the hair in it, as gross as that is, it's still just an amazing little touch. The bathtub, the gross bathtub toward the back end. Oh, it's so fucking nasty. But, it's not, again, not a gross out movie, but there's just these moments there's quote unquote dark water and then there's this clean water. And you can kind of tie these things together. But I agree with you. That was actually one of my notes where she feels like she's drowning all the time. Like the stress of life, of getting a job, of going through a divorce, of taking care of a 6-year-old little girl. I have a 7-year-old son. It's stressful. It's hard to keep a 7-year-old satisfied. And the truth is, you can't ever keep them satisfied. You can only keep them as satisfied as you can because they're a human being. They're going through things too. But you stress because you worry that, you know, they're not entertained enough. They're not getting enough of this. They're not getting enough education. They're not getting enough sunshine. They're not getting enough exercise. They're not getting enough, because that's the way parents think. And you're doing your best. And to me, as long as you're not smacking a kid around or berating them constantly verbally or something, I mean, you're a good parent. I mean, if you're there to be supportive and to be a support function, you're as good as you're ever going to get, because that's really all being a parent is. You take care of them, you support them, you help them. That's all you can really do. You can't make them happy 24 hours a day. You can't make their world glorious 24 hours a day. You might have that intent, but that can go sideways on you quicker than a slug in One Piece Someone's universe. But I think that all that stuff's tackled interestingly. Now, I don't know if Nakata had a child by this point. I didn't watch enough of the interview with him to see. But I do know that I did watch the interview with Koji Suzuki, because I do find that man fascinating, the author of the novel for Ring and for this film. And I've never read any of his novelizations of any sort. I've never read them, but I've seen interviews with him before in the past. And I think what I find interesting about him is, like I said, he never wanted to be a horror writer, but he developed into a horror writer kind of naturally with this fear that something might happen to his children. And that is a natural fear that if you have children, or if you, I'm not going to just say children, let's say you're a dog lover or a cat lover, and you go your whole life, don't have kids, but you've always had dogs, you've always had cats. You do everything you can for those animals because they're essentially your children. So you start to think of the fears of, you know, yeah. I'm gonna leave this animal alone because I got to go here for 2 days, and I hope that somebody else takes care of this animal the way I take care of this animal. I hope nobody else hits this animal. I hope nobody lets this animal out and it gets loose, and then I lose my animal. And the reason why I keep saying the animal is because it could be anything. It could be a gerbil. It could be a guinea pig. It could be anything.
Yeah, well, I've been, and the mother character here is, you know, she's very protective of her daughter, and, you know, combined with the ghost, you know, then you get, it's fear for her children and then fear of children as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think
on the other side of it.
Yeah, they're playing with all those kind of tropes throughout the movie, or at least Nakata is, and I think that's why. By the time the movie gets towards the end, it's the little moments I take away from the movie. The little scenes of, like I said, looking at the staircase or looking or finding the little red bag here and there. That's a horror trope a little bit, but it's just little moments like that that work for me, that work for the psychosis of the character, the lead character, not the little girl. The little girl's kind of a harbinger. She's kind of there just kind of get everything going and kind of move things along and stuff. And there's great little moments with her, obviously. I think she does a good job as an actress. I really do. The little girl that's in the film, I don't know her name off the top of my head. Okay, here she is, Ryo Kano. Ryo Kano, I guess is how you say her name. But she's really good in the movie. She has some great emotional moments and some and stuff. Of course, she has some, you know, child actor type moments, too, where there's a bit of awkwardness about the way she kind of acts and stuff. And I always find Japanese interactions between their children and parents kind of funny, because it's almost like they're screaming at each other. But I think it's the culture, the way they talk and stuff, because,
yeah.
You know, I've always done my Mifune impersonation on the show and stuff. the way they just, you know, it sounds like they're yelling at each other sometimes, but obviously it's just the way they talk and just the culture and the vocal inflections they have. And I'm sure they probably think, you know, New York, well, obviously, you know, people yell at each other up there all the time. And then in the South, we hardly ever talk. We just kind of, hey, what's going on, man? But I find that relationship works really well. I find, again, the isolation of having them together most of the time in the film, or having the Hitomi Kuroki character by herself a lot, that isolation works, because whenever another character comes into the movie, it feels like a strange force. More, it feels almost like a ghost. When the super comes involved, he feels like a ghost to me. When the guy that sells the apartment's involved, he feels like a ghost to me. I have OCD. Some of those who know me, I'm a little obsessive compulsive about things. And, you know, I can't walk past a stack of paper and not restack it and things like that. Just little things that can kind of cause me problems sometimes. Usually cause me to be late for work more than anything. You know, constantly, you know, redoing this, redoing that. Did I turn the oven off? Did I turn the oven off? Did I turn the oven off? That's kind of the way my brain works. And I never turned the oven on, but that's the way my head works, right? So the scenes where, you know, you see the water damage and things like that, that kind of stuff would drive me crazy. Because if I find something like that in my home now, like, I become obsessed with it. Like, if I find a scratch on a wall, like, every time I walk past that wall, I look at that scratch. And it's just, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. That's who I am. You know, it doesn't cause me to scrub my hands till they bleed or something like that. But it does sometimes cause me to maybe spend a little bit more time than you should spend on a scratch in the wall. You know,
yeah, you're not at Howard Hughes levels.
No. But I have this natural fear. I'm like fascinated by Howard Hughes. So I have this natural fear that I hope I never get to that. I hope I'm never sitting in my own filth. Naked.
Well,
well, that's true. It depends on what the filth is.
Unless it's like a Saturday.
Yeah. An onion sack, I'm not too upset about, but poo? Yeah. No, I don't want to be sitting in poo.
Nah.
Yeah. And I'll avoid the needles, I hope. No needles. No morphine, please. saying that, the way the film progresses, I think works really well. The way it's constructed, the building, the set they shot it in, I think it works really well.
It looks really old but modern.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is gray. The only color that you really get in the entire fucking movie is that red bag.
Yeah. Yeah. The red bag is essential. Yeah. And being the most kind of effervescent color. I know that the flashbacks are kind of shot with a golden hue, which is kind of nice.
Yeah.
So you'll know what's going on there. Because at first I think you're kind of thrown by the flashback.
Yes, you are.
At least I was. Both times I've watched this, I'm always kind of thrown by the beginning. I'm like, is this the story I'm in, or is this another story? Yeah. And then, you know.
Well, but then it also, you know, it's interesting because you start to get into the cyclical nature of where the story is going. Because,
mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, it goes from this little girl to her being an adult, to the little girl to her being an adult, to mm-hmm. the little girl. And, it, you know, it all goes around and around and around.
Yeah.
And it does, you know, a really, really nice job of constructing that through line.
Yeah. But by the time it gets toward the end, and again, I'm not going to give it away for those who haven't seen it, because it would be a crime, because it really does hinge on the back end of the movie, on how everything else is kind of set up. But I found those moments very touching. I found the decision a character makes, some would argue that that's not the decision they would make, but I think at that point the characters reach their limit and they almost, without giving too much away, they almost have to give up. Maybe not give up, but maybe give in. And that's not the emotional bits come from the other side of that coin played against that. So, you know, we're talking about the movie we both watched. If and people who've seen this know what I'm talking about. But
well, I think it's also what you're talking about is a bit of self-realization.
Yes,
this is the way it is going to be, yeah. No matter what.
Yeah, and then the way that it plays in the epilogue of the film.
Yeah, well,
that.
I didn't care for that. I didn't care for that epilogue.
Yeah, I know it's one step too far. I think they I agree that they could have ended where I'm talking about. And
yes,
and well, actually,
yeah, we get it at that point. Yeah, I mean that's.
Actually, the first time I saw it, I thought it would end with the one character seeing the little girl and that, and there's this kind of hesitation and quiet, and then that all kind of works itself out, and then I thought the film was over. But then there's this whole other epilogue, basically this whole other scene. That the first time I saw it, I definitely thought it was too much. I still think it's too much. It's a flaw, but I think it's a well done flaw. I like that moment. Don't really think it belongs so much. Like I said, 'cause I think it's a step too far, but because I cared so much about this person and this person and this person and this person, I kind of found it interesting. And also I found a bit of that chilling, the out of focus stuff. That's the best way I can put it, right? I found that kind of chilling, and that's interesting to me because, like, again, this, I tell you, this stuff doesn't scare me. This stuff doesn't give me the heebie-jeebies, so to speak. But parts of this movie, you know, get the hair going a little bit on the back of the neck, a little bit that little chill that you just get, and. I think it
connects
it's
emotionally.
I think it's a pretty masterful example of an emotional horror film. I think it really is. I mean, because horror films are, you know, we talked about Jason X in the opening of the show. That's one type of horror film, right? You're going into that. You're looking for effects. You're looking for fun. You're looking for goofiness or even slugs. You're looking for the same things. This film, you really don't know. Maybe you don't know what you're going into, but it's a horror film by way of telling a story about horrible things, and I think sometimes those are the most, especially as I get older, I think sometimes those are the most interesting films. So that's really all I got for Dark Water.
Okay. I really don't have a lot to add. Let me see here. Nakata does a really good job of teasing the ghost. I got a heavy Don't Look Now vibe off of this film. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of these movies, you could get that same vibe out of it. But it really seemed to be here probably because of the water relation between here and the other one being set in Venice and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, Nakata's maybe
it's just me.
Oh, no, Nakata's a film fan, so I'm sure he probably had seen Don't Look Now. I mean, that's a pretty pivotal 70s horror film. Kind of dealing with the same type of material in a lot of ways, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. That was the other thing.
I'm sitting here kind of running Don't Look Now through my head right now, and I'm sitting here thinking, yeah, water, children.
Yep.
Interesting. I didn't really put those two together until just now.
There you go. It's got a pretty tight script, narratively speaking. It works very, very well. There's great performances. It's not really a complaint, though. It is a complaint. It's a very slow burn.
Yeah, it is. It's a slow burn.
This is not something that you go into thinking that you're going to be stimulated by it every millisecond that it's on screen. So it takes patience and it takes involvement from the viewer, which is not something that a lot of folks want to give these days. And I can understand that. As for me, as much as I like this movie, and I did like it a lot, and I'd only ever seen his Ringu, so I don't know anything else really about Nakata's work.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But I know for me, this is not something that I'm going to revisit, constantly.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Just like Ringo. It's the same thing. It's not, it's not something that you really, really have to be in a mindset to get the most out of. Well, no, I think you still get the most. Yeah, I still think you would get a lot out of it, even if you're not in the right mindset for it. But I think it's a little bit more difficult to stick with.
Yeah, I think this is a great movie. I think this is a great film. Like if you came over to the house. And we're sitting around talking about sequences and movies or something like that, just having a conversation. I think this is a great movie. Whereas, like, if you hadn't seen this movie, I'd be like, "Well, let me show you this. let me show you this movie if you're interested in watching the movie. But if you're not, let me show you this sequence.
Yeah.
Let me show
you,
you know, things like that. But I don't think like The Shining for me or for like or some other horror films. It's not the kind of film where I'm like, you have to watch this whole movie. Because this is not a I think there's certain movies I think that are fun to watch by yourself. Mm-hmm. Certain movies, and this show is a great example of two different types of movies. Like, this is a very isolated film, so it's very, I think it's much more effective if you watch it on your own, maybe with one other person.
Yeah. Well, it's interior, yeah.
Yeah, but, and then Slugs is better, probably, if you watch it with a group of people, and everybody's going, oh, that's fucking gross.
Ah!
But, so, you know, you get two different sides of the coin on this show because... You know, I had a very isolated experience rewatching this. The first time I watched it, I think I watched it with a girlfriend. Or maybe my wife. Hell, I hope it was my wife because it came out in 2000. I married her in 2001. Wow. Yikes. Wow. Anyway, she didn't care for it. She moved on pretty quick. She had seen Ring and liked it and freaked her out. So she thought she'd like this, but she couldn't get it. It was too boring for her. It was too slow. And I got to admit, the first time I watched it, I thought it was pretty slow, too. I mean, I think I may even remember fast-forwarding through some bits of it the first time on tape. But, yeah, this time, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's the age and everything else, but I agree with you. It is a slow burn. A little longer than it needs to be, maybe, perhaps. And, again, a lot of it has to do with that epilogue, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
It's about maybe about 8 to 10 minutes. I don't know. I don't know how long it is, but
I think it's a little over 10. I think it's like 12, 15.
Even. Yeah. So it's a quite a long epilogue.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much all that I have, man. Yeah. It's atmospheric. It's emotional. It's damn good as far as the J horror stuff goes, and as far as ghost stories goes, and horror in general. Mm-hmm. It's a solid example of quality work in the
genre. We should say also, you know, it's rated PG-13. I think that that's
very dark for a PG-13.
It is dark, but I think that's a good rating for it because it doesn't really go in the blood sense or nothing that. But the I think that this is a really good example of how you make a strong young adult horror film.
Yeah.
It's really interesting that the fears and the chills he got out of I mean, I'm a hardened horror fan. I don't toot my own horn very much, but I mean, you know, I've seen just about the worst of the worst. You know, I've seen the bad films. I've seen the films that are amazingly gory. I've seen the films that are amazingly well made. And that, I mean, my door into movie love was horror, right? So that's, you know, and that's where my heart always lies first is with horror films. But there's been rated R and hardcore horror films that I don't even flinch. And then there's filmmakers every now and then that come along and can make a PG-13 film. And I think they do a masterful job. I thought Sam Raimi did a pretty masterful job with Drag Me to Hell, although I think that was a rated R maybe. But if it wasn't, then I don't know. But I thought it was maybe a PG-13 film. So, but I think really good horror filmmakers know how to scare you without blood and gore. They know how to scare you with atmosphere, sound, presence. And, you know, you take a couple gore scenes out of The Shining, and it's really just a PG movie.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm talking about. But anyway, I'm looking now to see if Drag Me to Hell is rated R or not. I got to know. I seem to think that it was.
I think it was, yeah.
Nope.
One of those ones that had, like, It had the alternate cut.
Yeah, it has an alternate cut, but it came out as a PG-13. So that's a good example of what I'm talking about. And, you know, I think Sam Raimi's a very good filmmaker. So I think that that's a good example of taking basics. And when I think about that movie, the scene that works the best for me in that movie is the scene, I think, with the piece of paper in the parking garage. Did you see Drag Me to Hell? I'm pretty sure you probably did. So anyway. Again, that would be a sequence. I'd be like, Todd, if you haven't seen the sequence, you don't have any interest in the movie, that's cool, but I got to show you the sequence. That's what this film is to me, too. Like, hey, man, you might not like this movie, but I'm going to show you this one sequence, and then if that gets you off, then first of all, clean up. Second of all, wipe up. Second of all, please clear your slug trail off my couch. And second of all, let's watch the whole movie now. So, yeah, good example of that. All right, so Make or Breaks, MVTs. This is a great release, too, by the way. The only thing I wish it would have had a commentary by somebody to kind of go over some of the things that I feel like I might miss. But
yeah, well, the cultural stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But no commentary to be had. There are some good interviews, though. Koji Suzuki, Hideo Nakata. I think there's some interviews with the actress. I know there's one with Hatomi. What was her name again? Kuroki? Yeah. And I think there's some audition footage of the lady, the girl that plays the teenage version of the little girl. But anyway, some interesting stuff on there, needless to say. Good interview with Nakata. Again, I only watched about 15 minutes of it, but he talks a little bit about his past. And, you know, I think he went to England to study, and he was a film student and all that stuff. So he's a guy that knows movies. So, again, another guy that – and, again, I feel like there's a lot of scenes in the movie that are Kubrickian. I feel like there's a lot of scenes in the movie that are almost like Robert Wise's – was it Robert Wise, I think, that did The Innocents?
Yes, I do believe.
There's some scenes in there that remind me of his work, which is another good example of how you do horror and ghost stories and can be pretty scary without gore and monsters, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If anybody hasn't seen that film, they should definitely check it out. Okay, my make or break. There's a lot, man. But I really like that scene where she walks into the apartment and it's just full of water. I really like that quite a bit. Maybe because it's, you know, it's a visual that you wouldn't normally see. But I really liked a lot of moments in this film. I liked the flashback to the water tank. I liked so many good moments. In my MVT, I could go with Nakata, but I think he has a much more – I think this is a very assured film, but I really like his work on Ringu as well. So I would, if we ever do the Ring films, I would probably give him that there. So I'm going to give it to Hitomi Kuroki because I really think her performance is pretty amazing. I really do. I mean, I think she's very real. There's moments of quiet that she conveys that are kind of heartbreaking in a way, like these moments of fear and depression and anxiety that I found just very touching. So I'm going to give it to her. My score for the film is an 8 out of 10. I really like this movie. It really packed a punch. If you'd asked me, you know, 10 years ago when I saw it, maybe however long ago it was, I probably would have given it like a 6.5, 7, maybe 7.5 tops. But I think, you know, the fact that I'm older, the fact that some of these things are fears that I have, being a protective parent and all those kinds of things, I think it really kind of packed a punch for me. And, yeah, 8 out of 10, man. This is a very, very solid and one of the better horror films of the 2000s, I would think. I mean, that's probably a pretty bold statement, but I don't know if it is because I don't remember. I don't remember. Maybe being older, I don't remember a whole lot of super great horror films from the 90s and the 2000s. I'm sure there's a bunch, but I can't remember any off the top of my head right now.
Okay. Let's see. Make or break for me is going to be the finale. It really sums up the emotional punch of the film. It really works.
Yeah.
Across the board because it's unexpected, but it's fully expected.
I should go with that too.
It's almost like an awesome Fabian kind of thing to say.
Yeah. No,
it makes no sense, but it makes total sense.
Yeah.
But
it's not mega but awesome. It's mega, mega awesome.
But it's just really, it just works for me. And it works for the story. And it works, you know, it's the perfect period at the end of the sentence. MVT, I'm going to give to Nakata. I think he shows clearly a very deft hand at building tension and using believable characters to create the story. Because this is, you know, this is character generated story. It's not plot driven. So
there's no horror based characters in this film. These are real people, right?
Right.
There's no like a wacky, like the guy that sells the apartment's not like a wacky, creepy groundskeeper or something. You know?
Even though the apartment manager's a little on the creepy side.
He's got this permanent frown that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Kinda, oh my God.
Those down lips are pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So my score is a 7 out of 10. It's very good. Very good film.
Is this the first time you've seen it?
My first time, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's probably where I would have fallen the first time I saw it, too. So,
and that may have something to do with it because, I mean, like I said, the biggest sticking point that I have with it is that it's such a slow burn.
Yeah. And I think what you said earlier, I meant to kind of jump onto that, too. I've seen it twice now, but I got to be honest with you. I don't know when the third time I'm going to see it is. It isn't the kind of movie, even though I think it's really, really good. It's not the kind of movie that I would watch often.
Yeah, yeah. So, you don't put it on every week. Well, I'm sure there are people who would, but yeah. I know that I am not one of them.
Now, I'm not one of them either. So maybe in 10 or 15 more years, I might watch it again.
Yeah, but, and who knows? Your score will go up again.
Or it could go back down. I mean, because I think life changes, but I don't think it will. I think it'll probably stay right where it's at. And I'm
still solid film. Yeah. I mean, regardless of
I don't know where
you might stand with it.
That's just not the kind of thing. It's not like Smokey and the Bandit, right? I mean, Smokey and the Bandit is something I can throw on.
Dude, that's a 10. Come on.
Easily a 10.
Every time.
Jackie Gleason alone. You some bitch.
Oh, my God. I'm in hot pursuit.
Yeah, I'm in hot pursuit. Oh, man, got to do the Smokey and the Bandit film someday.
Yeah.
Terrible tragedy of the Smokey and the Bandit 3. But anyway, yeah. But I wanted to piggyback on that a little bit because I'm with you. I've seen it twice over 15 or 20 years, whatever. It's 15 years old, so I've seen it twice over that span. I have no inclination to watch it again. I have the Blu-ray here. I have no inclination to watch it anytime soon. Will I watch it again? Possibly, but probably not by myself again. Probably more to show somebody something, or if somebody says, "Yeah, man, I saw Ring; it wasn't very good," or. Yeah, man, Dark Water can't be as good as Ring or something like that, and I'll be like, okay, well, let's sit down and watch it. And it's an hour, 100 minutes of your time. Let's talk about it. So, yeah, there we go. Yeah, so okay, that's the show. That's the big show. There we go. Hey, that's boom. What have we done there, Bay? Okay, so I don't know. I might not be on next show. The next show, I'll be on vacation. I'm actually going to be out of town. So,
well, don't count your chickens.
Yeah, yeah. Who knows? And
the way we've been going.
Yeah, I might be on the next show. Who knows? but we'll see. Don't know what we're doing, so we'll leave that up in the air as well. Yeah. That's about it. I want to thank Arrow Video, obviously, for sending us. Copies of these things and checking them out. They are really, I know a lot of people think we kiss their ass, but I really do think, and Will has said this before, they are the Criterion of genre film. And they really do really good releases on these things. And I think they really have their hearts in the right place. Mm-hmm. And I find it interesting the films they choose. Because a lot of times I feel like films are chosen due to rights and being able to get things. And I know from some experience of us putting out our own stuff that it's not easy. It's not easy to do this. It's a lot of work. And bravo to them for getting the rights to some of these and putting them out and doing the extra work behind the scenes and getting the commentaries done and all that good stuff, because they put out really nice packages. And I hope that one day that the OMG releasing stuff, the stuff we do with Martin and stuff, I hope that one day it'll be as solid as this, although I think our stuff's pretty solid. So, not to toot our own horn, but... Just wait until you hear that new commentary. It's so great that we don't even... I'm pretty sure, and I don't know if I talked to Will about this or not, I'm pretty sure, and I'm going to say this on the air now so people can hold me to it, I'm pretty sure we never even introduce ourselves on the new commentary. I'm pretty sure we're so excited by the way the film starts and by the way it gets going that we don't even stop to... but I'm not positive on that. I may have said some stuff. I don't know. So I hope you bought the first one or you won't know who we are.
No.
Yeah, anyway, all right, so that's the big show for this week. Todd, I want to thank you once again. Sure. We'll get together and do some stuff again pretty soon, obviously, and I think with that I'll say adios.
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com, and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com.